We're talking about inclusive healthcare and a patient-centered approach here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. An especially vulnerable patient population is the LGBTQIA plus community. This stands for lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, queer, intersex, asexual, and more. Patients who identify, particularly people of color, have experienced discrimination in healthcare, like humiliation, like harassment, denial of services. And a new guidebook says these barriers stem from providers' lack of knowledge regarding the type of care patients need and how to approach patients. Clinicians, is your facility becoming more inclusive? What changes can you point to? And patients experiencing barriers to care, what can you share? It's 800-642-1234. Linda Wesp is a clinical assistant professor at the UW-Milwaukee College of Nursing and Zilber School of Public Health. She is co-editor of The Clinician's Guide to LGBTQIA+ Care, Cultural Safety and Social Justice in Primary Sexual and Reproductive Healthcare. And her pronouns are she and her. Linda, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, good morning. Let's focus in on the acronym first. This is a growing acronym over the decades, which is a good thing. How has this community of people expanded and changed through the decades?
I think that all along, I always explain, you know, identities around gender and sexual orientation are what each individual person, you know, says that they are for themselves. And so I think in many ways, it's always been very expansive and diverse and almost like, you know, as many stars in the sky as how many identities we could have. But I think what's happened and what's different is increasing acceptance and increasing, you know, ability and avenues and ways to express that, you know, and for people to come together in community. And so we've kind of built out the long acronym over time.
Yeah, you know, a talking terminology here. Do you think that the precise use of terms in regards to gender and sexual orientation, can that help demystify the many misperceptions that are out there? Why is proper vocabulary and terminology so important?
Yeah, well, I think especially for you know, I'm coming from the place of as a clinician, as a nurse practitioner, I think especially for clinicians, for us, it's important because it helps us to kind of understand what context our patients might be coming to us from within. So, you know, kind of what their experiences might be, both experiences of needing to navigate discrimination and the resilience that people have in sort of navigating a world that may not accept an aspect of who they are. And that could either be, you know, family or larger society or whatever it might be. And even larger, you know, around discrimination in workplaces and housing and legal, you know, different laws that have come and gone over time. And so I think for us as clinicians, it's important to understand identities to kind of understand what our patients might be navigating so we can make sure we're not perpetuating anything harmful in the healthcare setting.
Yeah, to kind of, you know, say, I see you, to
yes,
you know, to give the patient a voice and say, you know, at least you know, you're here in front of me and I do see you.
And I see you. And that's such a powerful thing. I say that is my job is to see people, and I love it. Like, there's nothing better in the world than to feel seen and to be able to see people for who they are.
We're talking with Linda Wesp this hour, looking at a new clinician's guide to LGBTQIA plus care. She's a clinical assistant professor at UW-Milwaukee's College of Nursing. You can join in. Are you a member of the LGBTQIA plus community? Have you had difficulty accessing healthcare services based on your sexual preference, your identity? Share what you've experienced, 800-642-1234. Linda, you see patients at a clinic in Milwaukee focusing on gender-affirming care, population health. Can you give us a sense of what you are seeing, first of all, in the pandemic?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the pandemic has turned healthcare upside down. Mm-hmm. We've certainly responded. We're a very small clinic. I work at Health Connections, a clinic owned and founded by Erica Sinclair, who has had a, you know, vision of providing healthcare to communities that have traditionally experienced barriers to care, and that includes LGBTQIA plus people, communities of color, people who don't have insurance or are difficulty with insurance that covers the healthcare they need. And so because we're small, because we've intentionally always been focused on health equity, we have been able to pivot and respond as best as we can. I mean, you know, sometimes working in the way we do, you feel like you're just, you know, how, you know, you're helping one person here, one person there, and here, person, one person there, but you know you're making a difference. And so I think we've been able to respond and be flexible. I think that's been the name of the game for even the large, huge healthcare ships out mm-hmm. there. It's harder to turn a big ship, but, you know, telehealth has been huge. You know, all sorts of other ways of communicating with patients. And for, you know, for me, I have an established practice, so I know my patients well, and that's helped a lot for me, you know, with my patient panel that we've been able to navigate this time. And we've, you know, done a lot around testing and now vaccines to try to get them to populations that have otherwise had barriers.
You know, you say, I know my patients well, and I'm wondering how that translates with COVID, how you talk with them about vaccines, about testing. What are those conversations like?
I mean, you know, I've been working in HIV care my entire career, and I guess I feel like it's the same. I practice the same way that I kind of always have. I've just plunked COVID into the mix, and obviously I've had to learn about the science of COVID and the research behind what we're doing. So we're, you know, providing people with evidence-based information, but I've always kind of had a patient-centered approach to care. And I guess what that means to me is, you know, I can say, hey, this is what's going on in the world. This might be what you're hearing in the news. This is why you're hearing that. How are you feeling about it? What are you thinking? You know, and people would be, you know, scared about getting the test and the big swab that touches their brain, and, you know, and leery of vaccines, and why, how did they develop that so fast? And then I can share, you know, what we know and why, and other people, you know, other people are like, when can I get the vaccine? You know, like, can I get it as soon as possible? And so, you know, I think everyone just has a different place that they're at because of their experience in life. And we have to meet people where they are and be consistent and build trust.
And it sounds like you're listening very deeply to what they're telling you and what any of their hesitations or issues are, that what their barriers are.
Sure. And then, yeah. And for, you know, LGBT QA plus people and again, communities of color. I mean, there's good reason, long history for mistrust of healthcare. So, you know, we're just, you know, I'm one person and I can try to kind of build some of that trust and be consistently present is what we try to do.
Can you fill us in a little bit on this long history of mistrust and what has happened in patient care for this community?
Well, I think for LGBTQIA plus people, there's a history of the way that Western medicine sort of has pathologized identities. We've had, you know, sexual orientation, anything except heterosexual orientation for a long while, you know, diagnosed as a mental illness in the DSM. We still have what's now being termed gender dysphoria in the DSM, is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Illnesses. So just in general, Western medicine kind of categorizes into, you know, healthy and sick. And that can be difficult when what we were just saying before, you know, this is just who someone is and it can be difficult for us as clinicians who come in this way of like, I'm just here to see you and support you. And yet I have to give you a diagnosis about something that's just a part of who you are and not causing you illness. So I think that's a big piece for the queer and trans community is that their identities have been pathologized.
We're discussing healthcare with family nurse practitioner and HIV specialist Linda Wesp, who has provided clinical care in community-based healthcare settings for LGBTQIA+ populations for over 15 years. Are you in the queer or trans community? Have you faced discrimination or harassment during a clinical exam or in a hospital stay? What happened? Did the physician or nurses use your correct pronouns and respectful language? What could have gone differently? Join in, share 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about how to make healthcare more caring for all people and honoring human dignity to help solve health inequities. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The editors of a new guidebook say clinicians must look past the name on the insurance card and ask open-ended questions without assuming what answers may follow, mirroring a patient's preferred language in relation to body parts or pronouns. Are you a member of the LGBTQIA+ community? Have you had difficulty accessing healthcare services based on your identity? What can be done to help you feel respected and included? Be part of this. 800-642-1234. We have family nurse practitioner Linda Wesp, who is co-editor of the new Clinician's Guide, and she's with us for the hour. Linda, we heard from Matt in Wausau, who wants you to address universal health care. And Matt says, look, if you don't have money, regardless of your gender identity, there's virtually no health care. Matt says 40 million people in the wealthiest nation on the planet have no access to even basic health care. What are your thoughts on universal health care?
Well, I mean, I think when we're talking about health equity and access to care, certainly I think when we say the phrase universal health care, it means that everyone has like the means to actually access care without going into debt or getting a bill that they cannot pay, right? And so, yes, certainly in the United States, we have one of the only sort of, you know, for-profit insurance focused health systems and do not have guaranteed access to healthcare for all things. I would call it sort of a patch. It's sort of a piecemealed, very confusing system. You know, there are ways that people can get healthcare, you know, if you can apply and qualify, you know, for Medicaid and get, you know, exemptions for premiums through healthcare.gov. But that is a system that is extremely complicated to navigate. And I am a big fan of, as a clinician, being able to see people and get them what they need without having to navigate this complicated system. But that's all I've ever done for my whole career. It's because it's all we've ever had. So I'm certainly a big fan of universal healthcare. And then I'm sure there are people out there who are like, well, how are we going to do that? And that's not possible. And it's very expensive. And, you know, I think we just as a society would need to invest and decide that that's our priority. But it's certainly a complicated situation.
It sounds like you have to be very proactive for your patients to navigate the policy, to navigate what, you know, what documents need to be filled out or what referrals need to be made. And really,
prior authorizations, all of it. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And really be the stewards for them as they try to navigate healthcare.
Yep. I mean, I'm teaching undergrad, you know, soon to be nurses. And we just talked about, you know, what does it look like to be an advocate and, you know, nurse case managers. And that is so much of what, you know, we do as nurses is advocate for our patients. And with the system we are in, So much of that is just helping people navigate the forms and the paperwork and going to this place for that referral and getting that prior authorization for that, you know, whatever it is, surgery, medication, you know, medical equipment. Yes, yes, yes. It's a full-time job just doing that part.
Can we look more closely at stigma? Because you mentioned there is a lack of appropriate healthcare and community support for LGBTQIA plus communities. Where does this stigma stem from?
I think it's multi-layered. I think we have, and we talk about in the book, and we brought in, you know, so many experts on the history of stigma, you know, to kind of help us with this chapter. But I think, yeah, I mean, I think it's both sort of structural, or sort of we call it like the macro level issues of what kind of happens larger in the larger scale of society around just systems and institutions being set up in such a way that that people are either erased or marginalized in their identities. But then we also have what we sometimes refer to as, you know, internal bias, meaning or implicit bias, where I actually don't even realize my intent is to help and see people, right? But I have sort of a wiring that is causing me to actually do something that's quite harmful, that the impact of what I'm doing is harmful. And so, you know, stigma can happen at all these levels, at the big societal level, you know, kind of between clinician and patient. And then even we have it within ourselves. You know, anyone who kind of has an identity that's been marginalized can often feel a lot of shame and internalized, you know, stigma. And so what we talk about a lot at how that impacts healthcare is because the patient and the provider, we have immediately there's a power dynamic in the room. And so where it's really important for us as providers, and this is where, I mean, I think a lot of providers want to do the right thing. But I think one thing that we don't talk about enough is the power dynamic that's there. And we're trained to, you know, I'm trained to be told I'm supposed to know exactly what's wrong with someone. And sometimes I don't know, you know, sometimes, you know, and really what I need to do is listen. And then there's many cases. I mean, my fellow emergency room folks, you got to look at someone and know what's going on. We want that in some parts of our care. And then in other parts of our care, you know, sometimes we need to really sit back and listen. And the patient is the expert in their lives.
We're talking with Linda Wesp, who is a clinical assistant professor at the UW-Milwaukee College of Nursing and Zilber School of Public Health, looking at the barriers to healthcare. And you can join in. How would you like to see cultural safety demonstrated in clinical settings? What would that look like in healthcare? Healthcare workers, we want to hear from you. Is your facility inclusive to the LGBTQIA plus community? What has changed? 800-642-1234. Rich is joining us from Rhinelander. Hi, Rich. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are that some of the training that has to go on has to be a very broad spectrum training. And I'll try to be brief here because I'm talking about two situations, one in Oneida County some years back, and then one more recently in Waukesha County, because we have properties in two places. In Oneida County, when I used urgent care about 4 or 5 years back for a respiratory infection, way pre-COVID, one of the professionals, seeing a ring on my left hand, immediately said, jovially, trying to make conversation, "Married to the same woman all these years, Rich?" And I simply answered with no. Then more recently in Waukesha County, when my partner of 47 years was very, very ill and had to be hospitalized for close to a week, I noticed when I visited in the room that there were other people around, not the doctors, not the nurses, but people who bring meals, who do cleaning and other kinds of things, who are not entirely conversational or comfortable with people unlike them. So I guess what I'm saying is, the training has to be very, very broad to say that we are, for want of a better term, your guests will laugh at this, but the training has to actually say these people, these two men, are also normal human beings.
Yeah. Linda, go ahead.
Yeah, I completely agree that the training is not just, you know, there are so many people we encounter in a healthcare encounter, from, you know, the people at the front desk all the way through to the people who bring meals when you're hospitalized, et cetera, et cetera. And there is something often that, you know, and we have a little section, you know, the detriment of normalcy. And so what's, you know, what's happened and what we're trying to get across to clinicians, and I think us as clinicians need to be leaders and squeaky wheels in our organization, saying, you know, it is everyone who needs to, we need to have this conversation. And I think the best way to do these trainings, and what I found anyway, is to have a conversation so that in that setting, not with the patient, people who have questions or aren't sure or feel like for some reason they're, you know, they have feelings that this relationship, that these two men, you know, for whatever reason in their minds isn't quote unquote normal. How can we talk that out so that we can, like you said, help people to kind of shift their ideas?
And let's pause there with nurse practitioner Linda West, back after this news update. We're at the intersection of identity and healthcare here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the Center for American Progress, the Biden administration has worked to advance LGBTQ rights in the first 100 days. The Biden administration said this morning it would provide protections against discrimination in healthcare based on gender identity and sexual orientation, reversing a Trump-era policy. And a question in a new guidebook for clinicians is, how do we restructure culturally and medically negligent healthcare systems into ones that reflect appropriate care for the most excluded people in healthcare? Join in 800-642-1234. Linda Wesp works with LGBTQIA+ populations at Health Connections in Milwaukee, and she's co-editor of this new guidebook for clinicians. Linda, we're seeing the Biden administration reviving anti-bias protections in healthcare for transgender people. How do you feel about these moves?
Well, I certainly, I think that the larger both state and federal level protections, I've seen how that has made a tremendous difference in access to care for patients being able to use their insurance to, especially, you know, for gender affirming care for trans and non-binary folks accessing hormones, which is mainly what I do. But, you know, it's that like actual tangible piece, but the relief in people as far as, you know, when you're kind of at the mercy of large state or federal laws and being able to use your insurance to access the care you need or not, it's very stressful. And so I certainly have also seen people sort of breathe some sighs of relief with seeing some of the protections kind of being reinstated. It was quite stressful for a while there.
How problematic is denial of services for transgender individuals? Is this happening?
Oh yes. Every week, I feel like I get something still being denied for various reasons from various insurance companies. Yeah.
So what does insurance coverage look like then for transgender individuals? Have there been improvements in recent years, or what is it like?
Yeah, it's certainly gotten better. I feel like we've had, you know, it's gotten so much better in some ways, and then it's almost like there's stuff that's even more restrictive in other ways. It's just such a hodgepodge. There's so many different insurance companies and plans, and then
it's like a juggernaut.
I mean, I don't even know how to like sum it up in a reply, but you know, I mean, it's such a hodgepodge of things. Yeah. So, I mean, but it's certainly gotten gotten better in a lot of ways. And then I think some plans have gotten more restrictive, I don't understand how it all gets decided. Wisconsin Medicaid a couple years back had a blanket exclusion, and then we kind of successfully got that removed with some legal action. So Medicaid recipients in Wisconsin now can access all gender affirming, evidence-based recommended, gender affirming services, which is huge. And that was a tremendous barrier before. And that has made a huge difference for people.
I want to look closely at perinatal care. What barriers do you see there in LGBTQIA populations and trying to get perinatal care?
Yeah, so I mean, perinatal care, care around before, during, and after pregnancy, I think is extremely gendered and extremely steeped in assumptions about about mother and father, right? Mm-hmm. And so then for anyone who has an identity or themselves a gender identity or a partner who doesn't fall into the assumed norms of, hetero and gender binary categories is going to face lots of things. I think everything from being in a waiting room when you're not presenting as female necessarily, or from lots of clinicians who work in perinatal care are assuming the person pregnant identifies as female and saying mom and she, and so much of that is entrenched in clinicians' practice. And so I think it's a very, very huge struggle, whether it's a lesbian couple who's, having a baby, or a gay male couple who's working with a surrogate, or a trans man who is pregnant, or non-binary person. The list can go on and on of folks who are going to face clinicians who are going to, probably not have thought about all of the possible diversity coming into their practice.
Looking more closely at the medical side of this, clinical side, what type of fertility options are there for trans individuals before and after gender-affirming hormone therapy? What does that look like?
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty, it's quite expansive what is available technologically. There are probably, again, more than I could get into. And even in the book, we don't necessarily go into all of it because it's continually expanding. I think what's important for both clinicians and patients to know is that there are options. Mm. I think there's misnomers and misunderstandings, like, well, if I access gender-affirming hormones, I will never, fill in the blank, whatever it might be. I think that it's important to have these conversations with patients, with clinicians who have expertise in this area, to offer what the options are. And then we are still, again, navigating our healthcare system that makes these, quote, options sort of more quote unquote options because of the cost. And so, technologically and medically, we have lots of things we can do. And sometimes those things aren't accessible to people.
Just because of the cost barrier that you see, how steep could it be for instance?
Oh gosh, it's not totally my area of expertise, to be honest. I mean, I think part of the problem with our healthcare system is it's hard to know what the cost of anything is right now, because what the insurance gets billed isn't always what necessarily you'll get billed out of pocket, et cetera, et cetera. And I see that for people trying to access surgery as well. But certainly, it can be in the thousands and thousands of dollars as far as reproductive assisted technologies, et cetera. And there's different options for youth than there are for people who or post-puberty. So lots of options that are often, quite pricey. And so we need insurance companies to be covering that for most people to access it.
Linda Wesp is a clinical assistant professor at UW-Milwaukee. She's also a clinician at a Milwaukee clinic that focuses on gender-affirming healthcare. You can join in. Are you an advocate for LGBTQIA plus population? How should the state or federal government approach providing better healthcare? What do you see in the Biden administration along these lines? 800-642-1234. Vika is joining us from Madison. Hi, Vika.
Oh, hi. That was quick.
go ahead.
All right. I am a transgender woman, and one of the issues I have, of course, is that my voice doesn't sound female to most people. So when I go in for care, I get misgendered a lot, unless it's somebody who really knows me. So what I really want is for everybody to get used to looking at the chart, because I'm listed on the chart correctly, but they'll still call me he and him and male and make all sorts of references like that. I have, like, Dr. Gast in her clinic. They do such a good job, all the way down to the custodians who come into the room to clean, understanding the used pronouns. So it can be done, and it's so affirming, and it's so important to do that.
Mm.
But on top of that, I also wanted to talk about one of the big issues for transgender folks is so many of the necessary surgeries and care are considered options for cisgender folks. So whether it's hair removal or breast reconstruction or breast removal for transgender men, these are not really options. They're not, I forget what the word is for something that's done for beauty purposes versus necessity purposes. Does that make sense?
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Linda, jump in here.
Yeah. Yeah, elective usually, or, usually not something that's not medically necessary, right? And so then a lot of insurance companies have often like algorithms where, that surgery, it dials down to a number and then you plug it in and, oh, that's not covered because it's considered elective. And but if you pair the right other code with it, it should be, but yes, I mean, you are absolutely right that these are the barriers that trans and non-binary folks face in trying to access medically necessary surgeries that are affirming, that we know and have tons of evidence to support their use as medically necessary. And yet we are still kind of facing barriers, whether it's, insurance companies that don't follow the evidence, or just systems and algorithms in the computer systems when you plug through the prior auth where it hasn't been, accurately reflected. And I think, yes, I certainly also want to say that, how important it is for healthcare systems and clinics to have these charts set up and train everyone. We have ways we can know, just the way we're going to, make sure we have the right patient by checking a name and date of birth. You check and see, that person's pronouns and what name they go by in the chart. That should just become routine practice.
Yeah. What pronoun issues do you still see? I mean, Vika makes this point, like, look, it happens everywhere I go.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. When I talk to nurse practitioner students and nursing students, I've tried for many years now to just, as much as I can, remove gendered language from my vocabulary personally. We can do a great job and be very respectful, without saying, ma'am and sir and she and him. That's one piece of the puzzle, I think. And in my charting, I try not to ever use pronouns because pronouns can change. Mm-hmm. And that may not be accurate. And then I also think that then another piece of this is another tool in our toolbox is to ask with respect and share my own pronoun. My name is Linda. I'm your provider today. My pronouns are she and hers. What name do you like to go by and what are your pronouns? And I'm going to document it here in your chart. And this is, in our clinic, we always check. And so that anyone else who works with you will see this information here. And so in a clinical setting, I think that's a lot of big hospitals, a lot of places have started to do this now, yeah. So that it's there.
We're talking with Linda Wesp, clinical assistant professor, UW-Milwaukee School of Nursing, unpacking the problems facing healthcare today. Are you a person of color who is also part of the gay, queer, or trans community? How is your clinical care? Do you have a trusted clinic you can turn to? Are you an ally? Where do you stand in pushing for change? Still time to talk about this, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment with Linda Wesp here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The editors of a new guidebook to LGBTQIA plus care say, look, clinicians must imagine and redesign healthcare so the system can become inherently safe for marginalized communities. And it's about working on behalf of one underserved patient at a time, understanding that each patient has their own distinct narrative. You can join in. Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. The guidebook's co-editor is family nurse practitioner and HIV specialist Linda Wesp, and she's based in Milwaukee. We have her for about 9 more minutes. Linda, I want to focus our attention on cultural safety and what that is, what that means. How do you define cultural safety for the LGBTQIA plus patients?
Sure, yeah. And so cultural safety is sort of the foundation and the framework we use throughout the book. It's based on really important work from Indigenous and Maori nurse scholars for over, 20-some years. And I think it's finding a place now, and we've adapted and leaned heavily upon that literature to sort of say, hey, when we talk about what we need to do as clinicians, we've often talked about what's called cultural competency. We've even talked about cultural humility. But those things are missing an important piece, which is that I mentioned it earlier, sort of this inherent power dynamic between a clinician and a patient. And what cultural safety intentionally does is says, hey, what can we do as clinicians to level that power dynamic and create a space in that encounter where because we know we have health inequities, we have to do what we can to focus on that power dynamic as a source of those inequities and therefore address that, which in many ways, and we kind of talk about it through 5 components, but in many ways means that we are focusing on the patient also as an expert in the room. And any of my patients know, I say, there's lots of things going on here. I'm going to bring information and expertise, and you're bringing information and expertise. And that's where we meet and work together sort of as a collaborative team.
I wonder for clinicians listening, they say, oh, yeah, I have trust with my patients. They trust. We have, this is a two-way street. But there are so many issues that you're bringing up. And certainly even the white coat fears, right, that the clinician walks in and already there's a power dynamic. How do you know when you've earned the trust?
I think it's an ongoing process. I don't think it's like, you get it in the bag and then it's done. Mm-hmm. I think I think it's, every minute all the time. It goes both ways, but, I think the thing about the medical encounter is that, I need to trust the patient and the patient is needing to trust me. And so, I think we're always kind of, checking in on that on an ongoing basis. I certainly need people to be honest with me, or what we're coming up with as a plan isn't going to work because it's not based on truth. And then they need me to, listen and be present. And, we talk about patient centering, and I need to do my own reflections like, oh gosh, that didn't go well. What was I maybe missing there, in that busy day? And I, as clinicians, and we haven't had any clinicians calling yet, but, there's a lot of pressure coming at us. I've stepped away from full-time clinical practice because it burns you out. So, there's a lot that I don't want to say here at all, like clinicians are messing this up. I think we're just working within a system that makes it difficult to do this. And so we have to kind of pause and say, how can we do this differently for everyone's benefit?
And I imagine working within the system, you're really squeezed for time. There's only so much time that you can sit and talk with the patient until you have to take next steps.
Absolutely. 15 minutes is not enough time. for any to understand a whole person's history and everything that might be going on. And you know there might be one piece that they're coming to talk about, but there's probably so much more going on. And so it time is huge. And with the reimbursement system and how we get, we don't necessarily get, we have to see as many people as we can in most of the big systems to make the money. And so that's the tough piece.
We have Linda Wesp this hour talking about the Clinician's Guide to LGBTQIA+ Care. She's a clinical assistant professor at UW-Milwaukee in the College of Nursing. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Linda, what does trauma-informed care look like in this area and how you approach it because of the history, the lineage of medical violence?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think this is huge. I think not just trauma that's occurred in the medical setting, although we talk a lot about that, in a trauma-informed care approach for healthcare providers, it's understanding that, kind of coming with the assumption that understanding first the sort of physiology and neurology of trauma and how that impacts the brain and the body and trauma responses. And many people have experienced trauma. And so understanding when someone may be responding from a place where that trauma is being triggered, whether they've been in a traumatic medical encounter in the past, whether they've had friends or family who've experienced trauma in healthcare, or whether it's happened outside of healthcare, but the healthcare encounter might be, triggering something, especially when we're talking about reproductive and sexual healthcare. And so, a trauma-informed approach is a whole sort of one of our theoretical and sort of foundational frameworks that I don't think many clinicians necessarily have a lot of experience with or hands-on experience with. And so what we try to do is go through some scenarios. And one of the things I like to say about trauma-informed care, just in a nutshell, is not thinking in my mind what's wrong with you, but like trying to hold space for what might have happened to you. And so then I can try to validate that and what your experience might be in this space, even though I know I'm not doing you harm. You might be, something might have happened that we might not even get to understand in this particular situation, but I just can hold some space for that. So this can be a safe encounter now.
Yeah. And so maybe in subsequent visits or as our trust continues, that some of this will come to light, that this is a process.
Yeah. And it's not always safe to tell me everything that's going on because maybe they've disclosed something to a previous provider and that's been a barrier to get what they needed, in that healthcare encounter or, and some, when it comes to, like I was saying, reproductive health care, any physical exam. I mean, it's very vulnerable for folks who've, experienced physical trauma or sexual trauma. Yeah.
Lois called from Madison, couldn't stay with us. And Lois says that they met Gold Humanistic Honor Society medical students in a class setting that were looking to encompass more compassion into their work with patients. And Lois says all doctors, nurses should know this work, more empathy and compassion in their practice is so important. And I'm sure that, Linda, you echo that fully as well, that this is really hard, important work.
Yep, for sure. And that's why I love teaching. I think so many people becoming healthcare providers or getting to the next level of their education really just want to, and that's why we were so excited to write this book. I mean, people want to know, want to be more compassionate, want to have more empathy. Many of us have all been patients. Many of us are LGBTQIA identified or people of color who've experienced, racism in medicine or transphobia or homophobia in medicine. And so we don't want to be that provider, but sometimes we need specific tools and ways to know how to do that. And that's what we really tried to do with this book.
Linda, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you so much, Kate, for having me.
Linda Wesp is a clinical assistant professor at the UW-Milwaukee College of Nursing and Zilber School of Public Health, co-editor of the new book, Clinician's Guide to LGBTQIA+ Care. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.